a talk by Comrade Glenn Morris, and he's going to be speaking on the subject of what's in a name, and he's going to be speaking for about 20 minutes. So then we'll take questions and contributions from the floor. Over to you, Comrade Morris, then.
Well, thank you, Steve. Now, I need to tell you all, good evening to all of you, and nice to see some of you. I need to tell you all that these are just thoughts of mine. They're not something that I feel will necessarily strike a chord with all of you. In fact, my suspicion is some of you may feel exactly the opposite. But anyway, I'll start. As I say, Steve, I've written this down, so I'll read it. It's written in a sort of conversational style, but if it sounds mildly stilted, it's because I'm reading it and not just sort of winging it, as it were. Okay. The title is What's in a Name? And it's occurred to me over the years that we don't always think of how, with names, we define people, let's put it that way. Anyway, I shall begin. The thoughts I'd like to share with you here are not based on peer-reviewed papers, careful research, or culled from the minds of learned men and women. They quite simply represent a viewpoint, one possibly held by others, but not one promoted by the party, at least to the best of my knowledge. I would, however, like to share these feelings with you as a point of departure for discussion in terms of how we might see both ourselves and our fellow human beings. It's not a manifesto for change, but it might, in my opinion, be a helpful and productive beginning to initiate change. Now, let me begin by recounting a few incidents that have occurred over the last few months that I think lay bare the fact that I am myself by no means free of the very condition that I'm about to address. So to begin, I've noticed that I've acquired a distinct aversion, bordering on hatred, for black Range Rovers, particularly those with personalized number plates. As they fly by in their desperation to be in front of me, I sense that the person driving them is probably a male who cares nothing for the environment and sees himself, in a sense, as having arrived. Life has served him well, and as I watch him in the distance, as he passes down the outside of the queue of drivers, patiently waiting their turn, and cuts in just before the exit junction, I feel that no form of torture would be harsh enough to atone for his aggressive and unsocial behaviour. Maybe flaying alive and being rolled in rock salt. No, that's letting him off too lightly. A second incident happened when I was on a walk in the Welsh Hills near where I live. It's a place of peaceful solitude and a landscape in which concerns over the state of society can, at least for a short while, subside. I was walking down a track, heavily rutted by the 4x4 vehicles that use these old drovers' routes to test their vehicles, armed as they are with heavy ropes, iron bars and winches. As I neared the lowest slope, I heard the sound of powerful engines ahead of me, and coming my way was a convoy of 4 Land Rovers. All of them were covered in mud and decked out with all the equipment needed for extrication from deep holes. I felt an immediate feeling of antipathy towards them, this off-road brigade intent on destruction of this beautiful moorland. I averted my gaze and stood to one side as they lumbered towards me. Now, as they passed, without exception, they smiled, waved, opened their windows and called out, "Thanks, mate, lovely weather, and have a good day." I watched them wallow through the mud up the track and into the distance. Lastly, and again only a few weeks ago, a friend was telling me about his recent 4-day trip to Canada to see his family. This, I should say, is by no means an unusual occurrence, as many friends have happily regaled me with accounts of flying to far-flung places with no apparent thought for the environment. And they seem to share the commonly held belief that they have worked hard, so why shouldn't they? A sort of sense of complete entitlement. I'm not what has become to be known as a flight shamer, but there is part of me that feels resentful of this sort of behaviour when I anguish over how I can combine a shopping trip with a visit to the doctors to save a drop of fuel. So, what am I driving at by relating this all to you? The incidents are, of course, told in a slightly tongue-in-cheek manner and should be seen as such. But there is a more serious answer. We as members of a global society are encouraged to see other groups of people as different and perhaps threatening in some way. It is a wonderful tool of government, for example, to set meat eaters against vegans, usually through the media, and thus work a sort of divide and rule strategy. Many such divisions can be cited. Significant ones would include countries, political doctrines, religion, or race. So I've inadvertently fallen foul in the above examples of the very thing I despise. I've subliminally taken on a viewpoint as a direct result of my social background and conditioning. So why is this a bad thing? Well, at best, it impedes reform and useful conversations between people. And at worst, it is a divisive mechanism that divides people and entirely prevents a uniform response to the world's problems. After all, why should I take any of those Why should I take against any of those people? They are all the product of a very powerful conditioning system, a system that literally brainwashes them into behavioral patterns. It would be better if I started from the point of how much we have in common. I'd like to look at a few words, and this sort of reflects on the title, if you like, of this brief talk. I'd like to look at a few words or names familiar to us all, but for a moment, I'd like you to consider, almost shut your eyes, if you like, and how you'd form an image in your head when you hear these words. I'm going to repeat them one after the other. Worker, ordinary person, hardworking family, Christian, Muslim, anarchist, Tory, liberal, communist, comrade, benefit cheat, immigrant, country, and at last, but not least, socialist. Are not these words or names charged with a stereotypical image in your mind? Maybe you feel this is not the case, but let's be honest here. Let's consider a few pictures that slip into your vision, even though you really know better. Worker. Rather grey figure, one of a mass entirely detached from those others, in inverted commas, who somehow see themselves as different, not ordinary people, but people special and entitled, better, if you like, than a worker. Tory, tough, wealthy, privileged, wearing a suit, and perhaps a person that has little regard for those in less advantaged position. Comrade, Stalin, communism, Russia, or a man in a long coat wearing a Yushchenka. Benefit cheat, a poorly dressed, probably overweight person using crutches or probably leaving a gymnasium. For the classic image, I suggest you consult the Daily Mail. There are, of course, many more words that equally throw up an image type. If you belong to one of these types, your particular image of yourself would not bear any resemblance to this perceived image, which neatly brings me round to socialism. We all know exactly what this means, don't we? We know socialism has nothing to do with Blair, Corbyn, Hitler's National Socialist Workers' Party, Russia, or China. We know that socialism has never existed. We know that Greta Thunberg is mistaken to think that socialism, in inverted commas, has been found to fail. So here, as I raise my head above the parapet, I ask, how helpful is it for us to call ourselves socialists? Are we not making our lives significantly harder by having to explain to everyone that our socialism, our being in inverted commas, is not the socialism that they understand? In fact, in a philosophical sense, can we even give a name to a form of society that has never existed? Just for a moment, let's imagine that socialism, our socialism, came to exist. Would it matter what it was called? If wealth was produced according to ability and distributed according to need, would we argue about what such a society was called? And if you feel the answer to that question is no, then why are we worried now? The concept of groups, tribes, or parties immediately and before any helpful discussion has taken place implies a difference and division. In fact, it underpins the very form of society that I, for one, want to see ended. Let us for a minute consider the Socialist Party of Great Britain. An online search of the meaning of socialism definitely does not lead the inquisitive detective directly to the SPGB. In fact, it reveals only a chaotic jumble of mixed definitions and misleading information. One might come across the SPGB, but along the way, many avenues to anything other than socialism might previously have been easily taken. Many years ago, an SPG member, and I was a member then, when we were discussing the party name, said to me, "Well, if they don't understand the correct meaning of socialism, then that's their problem." Well, is it? Are we not making our objectives significantly more difficult from the outset? I mentioned the word comrade earlier. Can we not forgive anyone interested in the SPGB for not even in a little bit thinking about Russia from the outset? At this point, I should mention that I once spoke to a leading psychologist about how we take in information. He said that once a person had been given an idea or fact, then it became almost indelibly printed on the brain. So to try and change that person's belief and discard that notion becomes extremely difficult. This is largely due to the fact that if we hold information that we believe to be true, it is counter to our instinct to think we are mistaken. Furthermore, doesn't the term Great Britain create a notion of empire or colonialism? Even implying we are a country sets us apart from other regions of the world. I purposely did not use the word country there. I'm aware of how perhaps a change of name might be seen as almost heretical by some. But consider for a moment that if we are frightened or reluctant to change a name or approach, can we really expect others to be comfortable with change? Of course, there are reasons why people join parties, groups, organizations, or clubs that go beyond a shared interest or belief. These reasons have been studied and would include promotion, self-identity, strength in numbers, and a reinforcement of ideas, not to mention the obvious fact that we tend to be drawn to groups of like-minded people for that feeling of camaraderie and common ground. In other words, friendship. But the idea of alliances of politically motivated people with a shared viewpoint immediately sets them apart from other groups or parties. Wouldn't it be more effective and productive as a journey on the road to change if we started from the basis of what we can agree on, what we have in common, and what we all face in the future? If we have a vision of a society of equality and a society in which all people share in solving of problems, whether that might be food production, action on climate change, the environment, housing or medicine, then shouldn't we be starting from that premise? That is to say, we are all equal from the start. In other words, a party that does not set people apart and is global. Names on a postcard, please, for that party. And just after I wrote that, I made a brief, I was writing some more thoughts, and it suddenly occurred to me, if this may sound a rather obvious and perhaps slightly naive thing to say, but if the majority agree, they will acquire all the power they need for change. And when I say the majority here, we often refer in socialism to the majority of workers, the majority of the working people. But that's on the assumption they're going to come to that agreement. I think they need to sort of agree on the problems before they take action. Anyway, over to you. And I think that possibly took a bit less time than I thought, Steve. So there we are.